Hey, what's up, everyone? The Benes Podcast is finally back after a break of national team, draft, free agency, and now we can get back into it with none other than J.R. Holden. I'm starting a series on retired players, and I'm trying to get a grasp on what it's like of starting a new identity, basically. And the first person I thought to talk to was J.R. Holden. There's no need to introduce J.R. Holden. You guys can listen to this episode and find out more about him, about his path from the U.S. all the way to Latvia and then on to make a brilliant career. And, of course, about retiring, starting a new identity, creating a new identity by finding a new path and discovering himself again. Shared a lot of good stories, his biggest regret of his career. Really, really good stuff. We have deep conversation, and I think you guys will enjoy it. There's much more to come in the following weeks. But meanwhile, please enjoy J.R. Holden. Subscribe to this YouTube channel. Subscribe to on all the audio platforms. Leave a comment if you liked it, and press that little button down here. And yeah, enjoy this episode, and see you soon. Bye. I'm recording right now, JR, just because it's way too important to small talk, and we could roll all day. So I'm good to talk to you anytime, but this is a special moment. I feel like it's game day for me every time I get on this. So I'm happy you came on here.
Oh man, like I said, the fact that you chose me as one of your guests, I'm truly appreciative. You know, it's always love, man. Like I was just saying 2 minutes ago, can you imagine, bro, like 10, 12 years ago, we're sitting there at CSKA. I would have never thought Boston, I would be in Brooklyn. We're fighting for championships, opposite teams, Lithuania, Russia, U.S. Crazy, man.
Who could have known? Like, it's like, I'll get to that too. It's like the sliding door moments in life are ridiculous. Like if you're not able to reflect and appreciate upon that where you're at right now and really humble you, then you shouldn't be in that position. You know, if you feel like you're taking it for granted and you feel like you should, after a while you feel like you belong, but you can't just take that for granted that you're going to be there forever, because It's not a given, especially in this business. Things are going so fast that you just, like, it can be over any moment, and some people don't realize that.
I totally agree. I guess a lot of times for us, we're so busy on the grind, right? Like, you are a player, you went from that to a coach, that video, that back to coaching, you're still coaching, now scouting. I think a lot of times it's so much of the grind, we forget that it could be taken away, like, at the snap of a finger, because we're trying to get on to the next thing and be better. And you're so focused at times that you don't realize, like, hey, you got to enjoy just being in this moment and having this position, because it could be somebody else tomorrow, next week, next year. And a lot of times I think we forget that.
Yeah, we lose track of that, because it's just like we start living in this beautiful bubble, you know, and you feel like it's just glamorous and it's nice and you travel and all of a sudden at some point, if you're not able to put yourself out of the bubble mentally and realize that this is not real life sometimes, like you also have like other things going on outside of it, and just put things in perspective every once in a while, and you're like, man, I'm good where I'm at.
You just saying that, I think, is like so, I mean, I don't know it's what the metaphor is, but like, just think about the G League had the bubble, the NBA had the bubble, and sometimes they didn't even realize, like, the fact that they were in that bubble made them special. Like, yeah, that made them unique to the world. But they were so busy, somewhat like, I don't want to be in this bubble. We don't have this. We can't go out. But like, you're one of how many people that can actually even be in that bubble. And you missed out on the appreciation of being a part of that special group. So to your point, it's crazy that you use the word bubble and, you know, we went back.
Yeah, like there's like chosen ones, you know, they were the chosen one.
Exactly.
So I like, there's no need to introduce you to all the listeners. Like, I mean, like it goes without saying. And like today we're talking as friends and as like, you know, like just human beings being employees of two NBA teams, but like putting all the accomplishments aside, I told the tutors the same thing, you know, made the accomplishments and titles rest in peace. I want to focus on certain things that are, important, maybe more important, because it's significant paradigm shifts you have throughout your career, especially when you retire. But before we get to the retirement part, that I wanted to dig into a little bit deeper, because you're creating a new identity and you have to like really figure things out again. I wanted to get back to the story. What were your, like, I arrived to Tesco. It's like 10 years right now. It's 10 years right. Anniversary. So I was really appreciative. You took me in really you saw that I was brand new to the game on that level. And you took me to restaurants, you took me out. We hung out a lot. We talked a lot. And I felt like one of the guys. I was still young. I was 28 at that time. I felt like one of the guys. Yeah. So I want to just say thank you for just really take me in, and that laptop replacement story when I got robbed the first week in Moscow. I mean, those things happen in life, but you really helped me out a lot, and I want just to say thank you for that.
Venice, when I say man, when I touch my heart, that just means man, the love that we like truly. I don't know what bonded us like right off the bat, but maybe it was just your hunger to be the best. Even though you weren't the head coach and you weren't like the assistant to the head, but like you were just like, hey, I want to learn. I want to be better. And it's like we gravitated to each other, maybe because I started low two in Latvia and didn't really know what I was doing in York and we were trying to figure it out. But it's like we gravitated to each other and it was like a bond for life, man. It was like we both loved this game so much and we wanted to be successful. And to your point, I think a lot of times people don't understand like we treated each other as human beings first. It wasn't I'm the player and you're the video. It was like, hey, you're a person. I'm a person. We're from two different cultures. You spent time in the States. So we just got the bond over so much. And it was like, hey, man, I'm trying to grow spiritually. Hey, man, I'm trying to, you know what I mean? It was like, it was so much beyond basketball that I think people don't realize when you build these relationships, basketball is like sometimes the back burner of a conversation.
Yes, exactly. Like it felt so natural in so many ways, So I like it was it just felt warm, It felt like a warm welcome, and you like took me in, and it made life easier a lot. So speaking of Latvia, I wanted to get into that also just because it was a very, because I listened a little bit also to Hooptales' story. If anybody wants to check that out, Hooptales episode 5 on with Kyle Hines, it was it really interesting story of how you got to Latvia. And maybe not, like some people may know it, some people may not know it, but the sliding doors moment that happened at Duquesne, and when you like, you picked up that paper, you filled it out, maybe you can talk to that a little bit, because I think that people, it would help maybe people also understand that like sometimes you have to take initiative.
Oh, so graduating college, as we are figuring out life, as we're going to talk about later, after ball, right? You're trying to figure out life. And I wanted to play professional basketball, but it was during the 1998. I'm aging myself, but it was the NBA lockout. So my dreams of like being an NBA player, even if I wasn't, were gone because I didn't get to go work out for teams or go through Portsmouth or whatever. But to make a long story short, I'm working out down Duquesne and my mom is like, hey, you have until end of August to get a job. Like you're not going to be a grown adult living in my house, like working out every day saying you're a basketball player. So I'm down Duquesne and a good friend of mine at the time, Darrell Porter, was the head coach. And he told me to go in his office and wait. And on his office was like a sheet of paper that was like, if you want to play European basketball, fill out this and, send it in. And I didn't know who it was for. I didn't know like if he was saving it for somebody, but I see it. And I'm like, man, I'm gonna just take it. I took it out. And back, like people don't understand, this is the new age where you got computers and phones and it's so quick to get something. You had to mail this. This was one, it's like you had to fill it out and mail it in. And no lie, like 5 days later, a guy, Mr. Rauno, calls me like, hey, do you want to come try out in Latvia? It's 300, it was like $300 for the week. And if you want to come try out, do you already have your passport? And that's like one moment right there that it went from a sheet of paper. And I don't know if that's why he called. It could have been a million things. But in my mind, I'm like, how ironic is it that I fill this out and 5 days later, a guy that I've never heard of, doesn't know me, calls me like, hey, you want to come try out for a team in Latvia for $300? I said, sign me up. Sign me up. I'm
Man, $300. That's like in at that point, money doesn't matter. Like you just want to kind of go have a chance to at hooping. Like, you know, just like have some kind of perspective and continue to play after college. So I guess you just like take any chance that there is like any door that opens or just any loophole you see it, you go.
Yeah. I wouldn't say any door because I had turned down like a deal to go to Holland for like $1,200 a month. And Hungary, I think, was another deal. It was only for like $800 for a month in Hungary at that time. And you know, Bennis, when we went to school, when you get an education, there's a certain level of like accomplishment of when you get your degree, right? When you get your high school degree, when you get your college degree, and I just felt like I had worked so hard to get my degree that I just didn't want to take any job, right? Like, just like, oh, I want to play basketball. Yeah. So I just was like, I wanted to make sure it was a smart decision. And it's not like it is now. I didn't really know anything about Europe. I felt like I was going to a third world country. So when he said $300, he was like, but you can make $25,000. So in my mind, I was like, I'm going for $25,000. I wasn't thinking about the $300, if that makes sense. So
yes.
I looked at that as like, that's a comparable job when you leave college, right? Like you'll probably get a job for $25,000 to $30,000. So I looked at that as the dream chasing a real job, but just playing basketball, doing it. So I did try to weigh my options.
Yeah. Okay. I got you. That makes sense. I mean, like you had other options, but you saw that as an opportunity to really like, you already saw yourself making the team basically. Like you were so confident going over like that. The tryout is a tryout just to prove them that basically I belong. And then you already saw the 25 as in your pocket.
Exactly. I figured $8,000, like I could do the real job, $12,000, and nothing against people that chase the dream for that. Every dream, everybody has to choose what's best for them. At that time for me, education was super important to my mom and, you know, my dad, and they felt like getting a degree was important. So I don't know if they would have been okay if I said I'm going to overseas to make $8,000. I think they'd have been like, no way.
Let's find something else.
Right. Exactly.
Coming over to Latvia, was there like a certain epiphany you had, like that you felt like, man, this like the first thing that comes to mind when you felt like when you saw that arriving in Latvia, that was a different world?
Truly, Ben, it's the thing that I think helped me be able to be the person I am today and also be able to interact with you and not really feel like different cultures or different people. I have a certain respect for everyone, no matter if, like, you know, when we talk, I don't care if you're Muslim, if you're Pentecostal, if you're Baptist, whatever your religion is, whatever your color is. Like, I think when you experience something like that, as you have coming, when you're the odd person for the first time, like in a new world, as you were, Bennis, and I know if people know your story, you know, you were the odd person. I think you learn to appreciate certain things about life, right? When I got off that plane and no one spoke English. I didn't know where to go. And if Edgar Schneps, the captain of the team, did not come up to me like, hey, JR, I would have been in a foreign country, didn't speak the language and didn't know where to go. I was probably getting back on the plane and going home. Like, and, you know, my mom gave me a Discover card for $1,500 on it. Like, if anything happens, you can get home. Like, I didn't know like anything. So when you're in that situation and someone actually comes and says, hey, you'll be okay and you're safe with me. That epiphany was like, when you step into this, like you have to be open to people because you don't know who can help you. You're in a world where you don't know anybody. And if you have this attitude of I'm better or you don't like me, you can be stuck in the middle of nowhere with no one to help you. And I think that was the first thing that came to my mind when I got off that plane is no one looks like me. And I have to hope that they're willing to be open enough to help me get to where I need to go.
Yeah, it's humbling because you go blindfolded into a situation where you just don't know like which direction it can turn. Like you're basically on new grounds, and like it can be quicksand at some point, and you just don't know when it's coming. But like the thing, like you said, I think is most important that you really have to be open to that experience, you know. And like Schnepp said, talk to you. Kyle Hines said he had Jerome Allen his first year, who really, I think, mentorship in that first year to make that arrival for rookies over to Europe as smooth as possible. They feel like it is a new world, but they have to feel like it's not like the world is against them there. Like, they have to feel welcome. And like, the first steps are very important for them to take on their, with a helping hand, and make them just feel happy, you know, like feel like, yeah, it's going to be an adjustment process, but you have to also be willing, like, meet halfway and be open to that experience. And not like Messina said about communication back then and now. And it's just like, it's not right or wrong or bad or good. It's just different. And, you know, and then that's the culture also. You just come to a culture. It's just a different culture, and you have to embrace that. And I think that works both ways.
I totally agree. You couldn't have said that better. I couldn't add anything to that. You're exactly right. Like, it is being open. And I think a lot of times, especially nowadays, I mean, when I came over, you know, it wasn't as connected to the NBA and the world, both worlds being so close through social media, right? Like, you could just get on your phone and you're back home to a degree now.
Yeah.
When I first went over, I think a lot of times people come over too attached to where they left. Right.
Yeah.
If you come over thinking about nothing but America and going into the store and getting certain foods and everything being English and you missing your friends and doing that, if you come over with that, you're never going to be open to this whole new world of people really that want to embrace you, because you're so busy holding on to everybody at home. You're not even open to the people that are like, hey, we want you here. We really like you. This is a new world, but this could be a part of the, you know, we want to be a part of your new world. It's very hard, because a lot of people come. It's no different than players that come over and all they're thinking about is getting back to the NBA. Yep. They're not focused on being there. They're not focused on being the best player in Europe. They're focused on, what can I do well enough to get back home? And when you come with that mentality, it's really hard to be successful.
Yeah, it's really like, it can set you back too. Like, instead of like you going forward, it can set you back a step, because you're thinking you're too good for that situation or whatever. And you're thinking also already too far ahead. And you're skipping, not that you're skipping steps, but you're just not embracing that opportunity to really make the best out of that, and then, you know, let things develop on their own, and not just completely, you know, like let the game come to you, like play your game, be yourself, and then just let the cards unfold the way they're supposed to unfold. So it's definitely the mentality. There has to be a mentality shift when you come over here. But like that one thing you said about like, being on the phones, sometimes being on the phones with family back home, staying up all night. But like, talk to me a little bit about like what you see distractions that there is today versus like late 90s, early 2000s. Like that was my time too. The phone, there was just like the phones, just cell phones just started to come into play. Like social media was just like 4 or 5 years after that. Like it's just starting to happen. So we're fortunate to have seen both sides, but like the newer generation may not be able to recognize of like how many distractions there actually are out there.
Yeah. I mean, the biggest thing is social media, I would say. And it's, you know, when we were coming up, like I said, I'm going to age myself. Like MySpace was super popular.
I was there too.
Yeah. Facebook was just kind of starting. So it was like, it was a different world. Like I remember, like I had a cell phone, but like it didn't even call to the States. So I had to go to the payphone in Latvia to call home. So, you know, they don't even have payphones nowadays. So the thing of being able to adjust and just like get this ridiculous phone bill because you're calling home all the time. Like that's a distraction. When I was in Latvia, I wrote letters. Like I wrote letters to my mom, my sister, all those people back then I wrote letters to, and it actually took you time and it was authentic, right? Like you had to really sit down and think about it. Now, literally a person can pick up the phone and text something and it changes the world forever. They can be upset after a game, where back in the day, you're upset after a game, who are you going to tell? You have to write a letter to be frustrated. And then you realize like, am I this mad? Now you text something in 10 seconds on Twitter or Instagram and bam, the whole world's like, he's frustrated. And that's a big distraction for me, because a lot of times we're all emotional. We all have failed. We've all been successful. And I tell people, like, your successful moments, when you tweet or text something, it's just as bad as your bad. Because when people know your highs and lows, to me, the biggest thing about to me being successful is that you're always going up. So even if you win one championship, the goal should be to win two. So you don't have to, quote unquote, let the world know I'm the best. I'm on top of the world. I've always said, let everybody else salute you. Let everybody else say, hey, man, he was the best, or he was the MVP, or he was the greatest. Like when you start, like, I feel like everybody nowadays, and I won't say everybody, a lot of players are self-promoting. So they put out their own highlight tapes. They put out, I just remember when we were growing up, it was like, it was the And1 mixtape. It was different things where if you did something, I would be like, hey, Bennis, can you cut this up for me? You made the tape. It wasn't me sitting at home cutting it up and I'm putting it on Instagram like, oh, I'm nice. I'm playing in York. Hey, look at me. And I think that's a, it's not a bad thing. I just think it's a lot more difficult for players to stay grounded and understand that the grind is going to be day by day, as you said earlier, step by step. And you're really, until it's over, we don't know how good you are. Like, we're always chasing somebody. I was chasing David Rivers. I was chasing Anthony Parker, like Sabrunas, Jesse Cabbage. I was never feeling like I was at the top. And then there was probably somebody chasing me. And then somebody, like, then it was Bo McCaleb. I'm like, man, this dude from Partizan, when they're at the Final Four, I'm like, he's trying to come for me. Like, you know what I mean? So it was a thing of like, you kept chasing the next person. And nowadays, I think it's so different because individual awards and individual success and individual promotion is so much bigger than the team now. And I think that's, it's harmful and it's hurtful just because I feel like European basketball, the purity of it was this, is so special and unique to the world that it just makes it so much different than any other game.
I couldn't say anything. I couldn't add anything to it. Like, we're on the same page with that because I see all of those. Like, it's my high school coach told me back then when I was, when there was no social media and I came to the States, we were kind of like, we were vice versa. You came to Europe, I went to the States around at the same time. And coach told me, like, at one time I missed like a optional shoot around on Sunday just to come out. It was not even a shoot around, it was preseason. You know, it was like you can be there, you don't have to be there. Like, people are just open gym, whatever. And I was like, ah, cool, I'll go go-karting. But my host brother had a go-kart, so we're just go-karting around the neighborhood. And that was fun. It was fun. It was good. Like, you know, like, they had a PlayStation at home. We just kind of have a chill Sunday. And then I come to school on Monday after school. Like, he calls me into his office before practice. He said, Bennis, like, one thing you have to understand. That was like my first month in the States. One thing you have to understand, there's a whole bunch of distractions here in the U.S. Like, if you want to do it, if you want to make it, like, whether or not how far you will go, you have to start to, like, really filter things out, you know. And then if you have to, there's a gym or no gym, like, you have to apply yourself to be in the gym and forget everything else. And, you know, like, there's also guys who just come in to work out just because they know they're being filmed. They're just getting a nice little workout in, you know, like, for the camera, but not really in like, with their mindset applied to the game itself. So I think that we were fortunate to not experience it on that level as it is now. But there's always good and bad. It's like you said, it's just different, but I think it depends a lot on the people around you who put you in check, put you in the place. And like, I had my high school coach direct me early into the right direction, and it planted a seed at least, you know, and then it grew from there. But like, thinking a little bit about your playing days going back, because I prepared, like, I'm going here off topics of like that I prepared, just in terms of background, in terms of playing. Then we're gonna go into retirement at the end. I'll have four quick hitters for you, you know, as you know, coaching style. You know what I'm saying?
Come on, man. Look, I'm anytime I get to just sit here and chat with you, you know, it could be, we could talk for hours. You know this when we go to dinner, we see each other, we sit and just talk. We talk about everything. So this is pretty cool for me.
Yeah, like, it's, you know, like, that's what I'm. It's basically conversation. Like, I want to have a conversation with people. I'm a conversational, I'm a social person. So I enjoy, and like, this is good stuff that your experience is very rich, you know, like, in terms of like where you came from and how you really applied yourself to the game in Europe, and you grew your brand, let's say your game and your just career over here. Which season though stands out? Which season or situation or like paradigm shift within your career in Europe stands out the most, where you felt like you took the next step and took it to the next level? It's like, wow, okay, now I feel like I elevated and I'm here.
Okay. Before we get to that, that is something that you just said that I never even thought about when I was playing, like, your brand, right? Like, in York back then, everything was about the coach. Yep. And you, if you played for a coach that, whether it was Duda Ivković or Ettore Messina, or, you know, Dragan Sakota, right? Like, all these coaches, like, they were the number one person. And then the players went behind them. And it was like, they'll switch an American or they'll switch a foreign player in a heartbeat if you don't do the things that need to be done, especially when it came to winning and losing. It never was really about stats. So you building your brand only came with quote unquote winning. Because if you won, then other people wanted you. If you scored 20 points and you lost back in the day, it was like, he's selfish. He can't play with other good players. So it's funny that you use that word. It's like a lot of people really are doing that now, building a brand, and they're trying to make, you know, so many things outside of basketball. But when we were playing, it was focused on basketball and the purity of the game. And like, hey, I have to win in order to be successful. And I don't think that's quote unquote the same nowadays. I think a lot of people are successful without having, you know, championships behind them. And I think that's a big difference of a lot of players that come over. I wasn't trying to build a brand.
So I can move up. It's like, and I meant it in a way where subconsciously it happened. Like it, that word is embranded in me now, since like we're exposed to the brand left and right.
For sure.
But you're right. You're absolutely right. Like you, when you go through that experience, it is a competitive and natural process. When you're in the moment, you're not thinking about, you're like, oh, I'm going to post this and I'm going to like promote myself or my agents promoting my name around Europe on billboards and stuff like that back then.
Exactly. It's
about winning. It's definitely about winning. And then there's, like I said, like losing players and winning players, and winning players don't have the statistics a lot of times, but they have that certain it. Yeah. And that makes a difference. And that's also on our job now, where we're scouting, we're trying to look for that it, you know, we're trying to look for the difference maker that really is a winner and does not necessarily have the statistics to back it up, but he has something in him.
Totally agree. But to answer your question, I don't want to not answer your question. I would say probably in Greece. When I was in Greece, it was the first time where people, I felt like, outwardly doubted me, like, hey, he might not be for this level. Like, I remember coming from Belgium and everybody was like my first year, we lost like the first game to a team. And back then you played the cup first.
Yeah.
Like you played your cup and then you went into your league. Well, we lost the first round of the cup and they were like, you know what? We might have to cut him. He might not be good enough. This level's too high. And to me, it was like a dream to play in Greece, because when I was growing up, I'm about to name some older players that probably people don't remember, but like Ricky Pierce, Dominique Wilkins, Eddie Johnson, like all these David Rivers, all these guys played in Europe and in Greece. And it was like, if you could play in Greece, you were an NBA caliber player, because all these guys from the NBA usually went to Greece once they were, you know, older or cut from the NBA. So I thought it was like, man, this is my opportunity. And 2 weeks in, they're like, we might have to cut him. And to this day, I will say, like, Coach Sakota had my back from beginning to end. And the next game we played Olympiacos, rest in peace, Alfonso Ford was on that team, a phenomenal European player. They had James Forrest, Papa Lucas, a few other guys that played in Greece. And we had beat them in Ike. And it was like, I had a great game. And from then on, it was like, no questions about if I was talented enough. Now it was more based on, could I be a point guard? Like in Europe at the time, most people were like passing point guards. But what people didn't understand is I also got to see Mula Maravich play at Panathinaikos. I got, like, I was watching guys and I was like, he's not a passing point guard. He can score whenever he wants. So when you're going against those type of guys and you get to see the Kutalas and Bodie Roga, like, people don't understand. They were all on the same team in Greece, the team that won it all, Panathinaikos. So getting to play against them twice and beating them once and ending up winning that championship, I felt like that was the first time when we won that everybody was like, who's Ike? Like, it's always Panathinaikos, Olympiacos, Olympiacos. We won that championship. I thought it was the first time that I literally, like, finally made my stamp on Europe. Like, I'm a top-level player. Did I know what my career would be? No, but it was the first time I did feel like I belong on one of the top teams in Europe.
Okay, that makes sense. So that's to the next point I wanted to also talk is like the things that you picked up from like I picked out four coaches, you know, like that you've, like, one single most important thing you picked up from each was just Sakota, Ivković, Blad, and Messina. And if you, like, you played for a lot of coaches, but like if you can pick out one small thing that you picked up from each, or maybe they have something in common that you really hold until this day that you remember and you go like, man, that's that I cannot I know that.
Honestly, they were all great. They were all different. The one thing I would say that was a linear thread with all of them was consistency. Mm-hmm. Like all of them came into work every day with the same mentality of let's get to work, let's work hard, let's get up, you know what I mean? Let's do whatever it takes to win. All of them. That was the one linear thread was consistency. Come to work every day, coming to work at your best every day. If you're hurt, you should be doing your best in rehab, not just going through rehab to get, but your best in rehab. If you're watching video, you need to be focused, zeroed in on what your assignment is, what you need to be doing, what the other team is doing, what everybody else on your team is doing. I would say that all four of them had that consistency of you have to bring that every day.
I think that's a trait of any successful professional, you know, like if you think of like just be consistently persistent, like just continue to grind, and if you believe in what you're doing, if you really like you really want it that bad and you really feel like, and as a coach you are a leader, you have to bring it every day. And it's tough mentally, it's tough physically, it's emotional. That's why emotionally it's draining after the season, you know, like there is time for balance to get away because you just always have to bring it. And that's the toughest part about this coaching in general.
You are a coach, you've been a coach, so you understand how hard it is to be consistent and to make sure your players are consistent. So I would say that was the one thing, but to take something from each of them, I would say Coach Sakota, the first thing he tied to me was like, be myself. I have really played on teams that really allow me that. But on the bigger teams, it's always the stereotype of like, you have to be different. You have to conform. You have to fit into what, you know, everybody else wants you to be. But like Coach Sakota always told me, like, be yourself, whatever that is. If that's, you know what, playing fast, if it's taking a bad shot, I'll decide if you stay on the court or not, right? Like, if you're being selfish, I'll be the one to decide, but always be yourself. So that was the one thing he taught me at that level that was, like, truly, truly key for me because it plays into what the other coaches may have done or may didn't do with me. So I would say for him, it was that. For Coach Ivkovic, it was, like, the one thing I always remember about him, which is crazy, is, like, you better play defense in order to play offense. Like, he's the first one that made me really focus in. Like, if you're the best defender, you can do anything you want on offense. So he gave me the freedom to kind of be myself offensively. But defensively, he made me take my defensive game to a whole nother level. Like, I had never been with somebody that was like, defense, 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 like all the time. Like if I made one mistake, he was like, that's terrible. I used to be like, man, like all these other good one mistake. But he rode defense. But I'll honestly say he gave me the freedom to play offense. So the one thing I will say is like, that's the first time I really started believing defense wins championships. Because people say that, but they don't coach that way.
Yeah,
like mistakes happen, but they'll be like, hey, you got to be over. But like, he wasn't like that. It was like, JR, you're the point guard. You're the one that starts everything. If you don't do this, how can I expect him to do it? How can I expect him to do it? How can it's on you defensively. And if we give up a lot of points, I don't care who's scoring, I'm blaming you. Mm-hmm. So I would say that's the one thing I took from him. Coach Black, it was a unique Coach Black, but Coach Black taught me to relax. Like, it's a funny thing, but I didn't get Coach Black when I was early in my career. I got him when I was, you know, 29, 30, and I was growing as a player. And I felt like I could understand the game a lot better, but I always felt the pressure once I got to Cesca, like, if you don't win, it's the end of the world. Like, if you don't win, it's the end. And you know this, when you're at a place like my teams, like, if you lose a game, it's like the whole world came to an end. And when you're with that pressure, it's hard, and I'm sure you understand this, it's hard to ever just be like, take a deep breath and sit back and say, all right, we lost, it's okay, right? Like, you understand it. Coach Black taught me, relax. Like, win, lose, or draw, if you wake up the next day and you get a chance to compete again, that's all you can ever ask for. So relax, enjoy it, be in the moment. And that was the first time, and honestly, it's probably some of my best basketball with Coach Black, because it was like, relax and be in the moment. Miss or make, you're good. I'm not taking you out. Like, just be you, relax. And I think he taught me how to just relax, like truly in the game, actually relax. When you're running, you know, your mind is going fast and you're moving fast, I felt like I had a certain level of like, I see everything happening before it happens, because he's like, no matter if you make a mistake or not, everything is okay.
Yeah.
And my last one, Coach Messina, it's funny, is like I had almost had two different Messinas, and you'll know this. Like, you had the Messina before, you know, his brother died and had and that was a real tough time for him. His son got sick at one of our Final Fours, as you know, which was also a tough time for him. So for me, I had the Messina that said, when I'm on this basketball court, I have no friends. There's nothing about this game of basketball that I will kill you to win. But Messina also taught me that when you get off the court, you can't be who you are on the court. Mm-hmm. There's a time, like, you have to be open to reading books. You have to be open to sitting down and not taking what I may have screamed at you about on the court, taking it personal off the court. Because for me, when a coach screams at me on the court, I feel like we ain't friends. So when we off the court, I'm giving you the head nod. Like, I'm not trying to be cool with you. But Messina kind of taught me the difference of, like, when you're on the court, it's focused, it's competitive, you're a warrior, no friends. But off the court, I need you to be open to letting me talk to you as a man and ask you about your family and certain things, because I would take it personal. You know how Coach Messina is. He's so tough on the court. It's like, I don't really want to be cool with you off the court. I only want to be your friend. And he taught me that, though. Like, hey, there's a certain, like, I'm this way on the court, but I'm a human off the court too. When someone in my family's hurt, I'm hurt. If I say hello to you and you don't speak to me off the court, that affects me, because I'm a man. I'm a human just like you, even though you see me as this hard-nosed, militant coach. That's not, you know, who I am off the court. So he really taught me that. So I would say all of them taught me something different, both on and off the court.
Yeah, that's great. There's a lot of value in all, like, especially the human value that you care until this day. You know, like, you can separate the two, and that's with Messina. That was something that really, we went out to dinners, you know, after it was all said and done, and we had some like losses, and then we went to dinner also, and that's what shows you, like, game is game, and you leave it all out there. You leave all the frustration out there, but then you can go still to dinner and still, like, have, even though you have some conversations about the games and stuff like that, but you are, at the end of the day, you are a human being, and you have to learn to live with these emotions and not just completely absorb yourself in it. And I struggle with that sometimes with national team, because, you know, when you apply yourself that much emotionally, like, especially this summer, like, it was, you invest everything. It's like a relationship too. Like, if you invest everything into the relationship, you risk getting hurt too. You know, like, you open up yourself up. And if you're just standing in the middle somewhere, it's like, oh, whether it happens or not, like, it's cool. Like, it's not going to hurt, but you're not going to experience the love either. Like, it's going to be like somewhere in the middle, and you're never going to be the 100% love or 100% disappointment. So I choose, that's my life philosophy. Like, I choose to really, like, invest myself in whatever I do as much as I can. Yeah, sometimes it's impossible to be, I think, 100% into relationship, 100%. I don't think it's healthy to be 100% into everything, because you're just going to burn out. But it is important to really, whatever you do at that moment, apply yourself fully and live with the results afterwards, whether they're high or they're low. And it took me like 2-3 weeks. I didn't talk to anybody about the national team 2 weeks. Everybody were like, people were asking me or texting me. I just, like, it hurt. Like, it's a deep cut, you know, and I'm like, I don't want to talk about it. Like, don't ask me about it, but just because it's something that you, like, I experienced loss. Like, I'm going through a how you call it? Like, it's just a period of loss where you're just completely empty, and you just don't want to bring those emotions back up. And I'll struggle with that for a while. I struggled with that with the 2012 Final Four. You know, I didn't watch the game for a year. Like, it was painful, you know. So those things. But let me talk about Messina. You initially, you struggled a lot to really, you know, to be the point guard that he wanted you to be. And there was like a real period of like, you didn't know whether or not it's gonna work out. Talk to me a little bit about how you went through that adaptation process.
It's hard. It's really when I look back at it, I think we both, me and Coach, could have handled it probably better, right? When you look back at it. But during that time, we had went to 3 Final Fours before Coach Messina came to CSKA. And when he came, it's like he came kind of already with a plan. of what he wanted to do and how to implement it. And I already had my own plan. Like, I had been to 3 straight Final Fours. I'm not going to a 4th and losing. Like, I'm tired of losing. And he comes in and he's basically like, y'all can't win because of the way you play. And he said it without really saying it, but he would have just didn't come out and say, it's the way you play. He's like, well, you got to be this way and you got to be this if you want to win. And in my mind, I'm thinking like, what? I seen Tyus Edney, who played for you at Benetton. Like, he was incredible. Don't tell me, like, I want to play like him. I don't want to become this different point guard. And it's funny because when we clashed heads, he took me off the point. And most people don't realize this. Our first championship I won as the shooting guard. He had moved Dave Vanderpool to the point that year, about midway through the season. And he just put me and Trajan on the wings. And it kind of benefited us because I did kind of just play unconsciously, just made shots versus Barcelona to help us beat Navarro and Shamon Williams and that team. But honestly, it was him sitting me down when it was over the following year was, to me, the tide turner. It was when we lost the next year in Greece, when I think I was at my lowest as a professional basketball player. I felt like it was the first time I had ever not started in the second half of a game in my career overseas. It was the first time that I felt a coach felt like he could win without me. We didn't win, but I felt that for the first time. And it was the time I wanted to leave. Like, I wanted to leave Cesca. If it was going to be him or it was going to be me, I'm okay. And I was okay with it. Like, I thought my time was up there. But getting home, watching the game, and actually talking to my trainer at the time, my close friend, my brother Darius, he was like, you built something at Cesca. You have to give up your pride and go figure this out. Like, you're so gung-ho on doing it your way that he probably believes he could do it your way too, but you guys are so both bullheaded. Like, you just want to do it. Messina wants to do it. And he's the head man. He's like, he's going to do it his way. So try to work with him. And I went back over. And at first, I think Messina thought I was like joking or like being sarcastic, because I was like, how can I help? Like, how can I help us get this? Like, how can I? And he's looking at me like, really? Like, so for 2 years, we fight every day. Now all of a sudden you're coming back like, hey, how can I help? What can I improve on? But I can honestly say, like, after probably the 3rd or 4th meeting, he got it. It clicked. And it didn't click like we became like this. No, we still were like, whoop, whoop, whoop. But when his brother was sick, man, it chokes me up to this day, because it's the first time Coach Messina ever pulled me aside and told me he loved me. We were on our way to the Final Four in Prague, in Madrid. And he put his arm around me. He's like, hey, we don't make it this far without you. And we can't win this if you don't play your best basketball in Madrid. I had so much going on this season that I know I needed you to be the leader of the team, and you've done a great job, but you can't stop now. And if we win it, it's all on you. And if we lose it, it's all on you. But I want you to know I love you. And no matter what happens, you just be your best. Wow. Coach Messina had never spoken to me like this in 3 years. Wow. I got to see another side of him that I said, man, I'll do anything for that man. Like, to this day, that one conversation changed my whole perspective on him, not as this as a coach, but as a man. And how I grew up, I didn't have a lot of men just come up to me like, yo, I love you. Like, that's not how I grew up. So when he said it, looked me dead in my eyes, almost in tears, it moved me. And we weren't losing in Madrid. I don't care if they were going to have to kill me on the court for us to lose, because it just changed my whole view of him as even just a man.
Yeah, that's deep. You know, that's really human, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you show the human side. You really show that you're more than just a coach, and that's, I think, you also help players to gravitate towards you because you are open up to them. And I think that's the strength of a coach as well, to show to coaches to be humble and to be open also to the experience of a player, you know, and then also just opening up through these human personal experiences, that makes the player understand, like, yeah, we are all in the same boat. We are all like going through the same things, similar things on and off the court. So let's make this work. Before I go into this retirement paradigm shift, identity shift. Let me stop real quick because my headphones are messing up, and I wanted just to quickly see if that works or not.
Yeah.
All right, we're continuing. I had a short stoppage there with my beats. I'm gonna blame it on the beats. So let's go into retirement phase that you went through, and all of the players that stopped playing also went through, as like change of identity, losing your tribe, losing the locker room. But before we go into the loss of your friendships, kinships, the debates with Trajan that you had every day, I'm sure that was also something that you cherished at the time and afterwards as well. But before that, when did the first thoughts start sneaking in?
Honestly, Bennis, I never even thought about retirement until I failed the physical in Russia going into my last year. You always know it's going to come to an end, but when you're playing, you don't really think like, oh, let me start preparing for after basketball, right? At CSKA, it was so focused on championships, Final Fours, that if you started thinking about retirement, you was going to lose your job or you weren't going to play well. That's how I felt. I'm not saying that that's true, but I'm just saying that's how I felt. But when I failed the physical and they were like, oh, you have a heart situation, your heart beats irregular when you start running super fast on a treadmill, or, you know, the tread thing that you have to take your physical on every year. Yeah. I had never failed a test before, so I didn't quite understand. I'm like, okay, so I'll take the test again. Well, the Russian doctors wouldn't approve me to play. They were like, we can't approve you to play. So I ended up going to Houston. I went to Minnesota and I ended up going to Austria. And during this whole time, Ben, it's like, I'm thinking like, do I really want to go through all this to play basketball? Right. Like, on the one hand, I had my daughter at the time and I'm like, man. And you start thinking about Reggie Lewis. You start thinking about people that died playing basketball for heart reasons. So, you know, Hank Gathers, the guy from Loyola Marymount. So you're thinking this in your mind and you're like, I've been playing this long. Is it time for me to just give up basketball? So you're fighting the one part of like, maybe it's time, but you're also fighting it because like, this is kind of all you knew as an adult and you feel good. You're playing well. You feel like, I got at least 5 more years in me. So
yeah.
I go through that. The Minnesota doctor kind of is like, hey, I know a lot of athletes that have this. It's nothing to really worry about. You know, just keep it monitored. You can come back every 2 years. I had to go to Austria because the Russian doctors still were like, hey, you have to get 2 or 3 people and someone in Europe to approve you to play. So I went to Austria. I was there for a week, ran all these tests, all this, and then they ended up approving me. So then I go back to Russia. When I go back to Russia, it's just an interesting time because we had a new coach who was Serbian who didn't really speak English at the time. I think it's Dule was his name. Yep. And he didn't speak English. And we were going through this test. He really liked Jamon Gordon. They had went to the States and beat the Cleveland Cavaliers. So it was like, hey, you have to go through all these other things before you play. So I'm thinking, I've been here 9 years and you put me through this to play basketball and I've been approved by doctors. I'm in shape. How long do I need? No lie. We started off 0-4 or 0-3 in the EuroLeague. Then all of a sudden it's like, hey, JR, you could play. So mind you, this whole time I'm not playing. I have a problem with that, Dennis. You know me. I'm like, hold up. You got me over here sitting on this bench like I'm the worst player in the world. We've been to 8 straight Final Fours and this is what you're doing to me? So he ends up playing me. And right then, and I don't want to get into the season, but right then is when I said, I think this is going to be it because I don't want to have to go through what I went through all these tests to play. And I don't want to play for a coach that may not believe in me because of these tests. So right then I was like, I'm going to work the hardest. I'm going to try to win everything. And this is going to be like, this is my swan song season. I didn't tell anybody. I didn't tell my mom, my dad, my girlfriend, who's now my wife. I didn't tell anybody, but I said, I'm going hard. Like, I'm gonna be the hardest worker on the team. I'm gonna do everything like it's my last time playing. And that's what I just made the decision. Like right then, it was probably the fourth EuroLeague game. We were 0-4. He was just starting to play me. And I was like, I'm gonna try to do everything to make this a special season.
And you did. You really like finished with the Russian championship at the time, and we would not have met if that wouldn't have went that way the way it went. So without getting into the season too much, but right. it's definitely like the decision. I'm sure is a tough one. But did you think anything what's ahead during that time, or did you was just like in the moment and like not thinking really what's going to come after?
You do, because during that time I had already started, like the year before, I had a good friend that told me like, hey, start writing down all the stuff that just has been happening in Europe. So after the Olympics, I kind of started taking notes on like what was going on in Europe, my feelings on road trips, winning and losing. So I knew one thing that I wanted to, I never thought of a book, but I was like, I want to put something together for my daughter, because she's not going to really remember this. She's 4 years old. She's 3 years old. She's not going to remember all this stuff going on. So I was doing that. And as I was doing that, I was thinking like, what's next after this? And the easiest thing is always coaching, right? And then I always thought maybe teaching, right? Getting back in the school system and teaching. So those were the two things that were heavy on my mind going through probably from 2009 to 2011, 12, when I retired, 11. Were the two things I thought I kept thinking about, just like, hey, I want to finish this manuscript because I want to give it to my daughter for her 16th birthday. And I want to think about what I want to do after ball. And right now it's probably teacher coach.
Okay. All right. So, but the early on,
the thing is that you read about all these stories of people that have done great things after ball. And you also read about all these people that have done terrible after basketball. Like everybody usually goes broke within the first 5 years of their done playing. They lose all their money. You think about like, hey, what are you doing with all of your time? Like you lose your money because you have nothing to do with your time. So what are you doing? You're just spending money and you're trying to hold on to who you used to be. And you're somewhat trying to live in this new world that doesn't see you in that light that you used to be in. And during that time for me, it was just like, I was lucky. I had, you know, a girlfriend and a daughter. And my focus was like to spend time with them and try to figure out what you want to do. But when I was playing, I just kept thinking like, I don't want to be that. Like, I don't want to be the guy that loses everything because I have all this free time and I have no sense of direction. And I think the blessing for me is that I never played in the States. I never played in the NBA. I played in college, but never in the NBA. So I didn't come back to something where I was trying to be somebody I wasn't. I'm not a tall dude. I can walk around anywhere. Nobody thinks I'm a former basketball player. So I don't have to show this ego or this, oh, I used to do this. And I think that's truly, truly important, because when you come back home, to your point, who you're surrounded by kind of pushes you in a direction of who you're going to be. Like if you got people that want to hang out and party, chances are you're going to do that. If you got people that want to get into investment opportunities, you're probably going to do that. So for me, it was really having, as you said, my new community and my new tribe really being close knit and being an air for me to lean on when I went through my struggles. Because I think everybody, when they get done playing, struggle, because the first thing was the coach. And I knew in my heart, I didn't really want to coach.
Yeah, that's one you feel like in the gut, like you know what the right decision is or not. You know, like whether or not you should coach or not. Like your insight will tell you, but the surroundings, I think you have to get lucky with that too. Like you can't really, you can control some of it. You can, like, if you have, like, you can see both sides. You can say yes or no to either. But a lot of times, like a lot of former players, they don't have the good side. They just have this side where it's just going to be about spending and, like you said, living in the past with the past identity, and that's going to be a really hard wake up call with the, you know, whenever it's all gone, and then all of a sudden you just like continue to dig yourself a hole and not living the moment and not really looking forward, but just stuck in the past. And it's a very difficult thing to manage if you don't have the people around you. By yourself, you have to be a really reflective person, really read a lot, really be cognizant of it. And like you said, like with your playing days, like you're like
being able to swallow your pride at that time and at that moment and move on, you know, and it's not really the easiest part to move on.
The hardest part, I would say, is just what you said, your friends around you and your pride. And I won't even say it's so much your pride. Maybe it's even your ego, right? Like your friends around you, even though the money stopped coming in, their expectations doesn't change, right? If you gave them $5,000 a week when you were playing, they expect their $5,000 a week, right? Like you're done playing. If you were always like, I was never a big club person, but if you always went to VIP when you're in a club and you spent $10,000, when you're done playing, they still expect to go VIP and for you to spend $10,000. They don't expect you to have to walk in or stand in the regular line now, right? If you took private planes when you went places, they expect those things to continue. And your pride and ego get in the way of you want to still act like you can live that life. Like, oh, yeah, let's go get the private jet. Oh, yeah, let's go get this bottle or let's go get, you know, let's go get this $10,000 table at the club. But the reality of it is we all have to grow up. And the things that excited you at 23 probably shouldn't excite you at 33 and probably shouldn't excite you at 43. Like if I'm doing what I'm doing at 23, like something's probably a little off, right? But I think you hold on to it because you don't have anything to look forward to. See, when we were basketball players, we always look forward to next season. We always look forward to trying to win a championship or trying to be the best player or average 20 points or whatever it is that each player individually wants. So you knew every summer what you were working for. When it's gone, what are you working for? What are you looking forward to? Like, it's hard to look forward, and even myself, it's hard to look forward to buying property. That's not my lane. I'm sitting here looking at comps, and you're like, eh. Then the person comes in and talking to you. If you don't love it, and that's my major thing with anybody that's playing right now, find something that you kind of really like that you think you can grow to love after basketball. Because if it's social media, find whatever lane you can get in to be a part of something in social media that expands your social media. I don't mean just posting pictures of yourself or where you're like, if that's what you love, then try to figure out how you can make that a business opportunity. If you love, you know, property, maybe you could start reading books on being a realtor so you can get your realtor, you know, your real estate license. Like Breon Rush has his real estate license. Like maybe that's something he always looked forward to. I always say, if you can find something else you're passionate about, it'll allow you to comfortably move into your next life without, or next phase of life without the struggles of, but I used to play basketball, but I used to do this. And everybody's pride gets in the way. When you walked in a room when you're a basketball player, everybody turns like, oh, that's JR, right? When you walk into a room when you're done playing basketball, they're like, I don't even know who that is. Like, there's kids, like, I can go over to Russia right now or go to Spain right now. A 25-year-old probably doesn't even know who I am. Are you okay with that? Or do you have to wear a Seska shirt for people to like, oh, yeah. You know what I'm saying? No, but it's like that a lot of people, you know, they struggle with that, just being a normal person.
Yeah. To your point with the surroundings, is there's a lot of peer pressure that comes into that, where you have to feel, you feel like you deep down, you probably know that it shouldn't be that way, but you just kind of also, like you said, your ego comes in the way, and then the peer pressure, you just like starts crumbling. But yeah, the identity where you find something that you really can invest yourself, a new avenue and create your new identity, I think is the most important thing. And you, early on, whenever you did retire, I remember we saw each other in Vegas, and you were getting an agency license. So you were like dabbling in different avenues. You were, I think, remember we're on a road with Trajan also, and I'm sure debating a lot and talking.
For sure.
What were the things you were dabbling in, and how did you go about like just finding that new avenue early on?
Honestly, it's crazy. Like when I first got home, kind of put a book together, traveled a little bit with a good friend, trying to like promote the book, right? Really not for sales, but just to promote really to athletes. It was really focused on like college athletes. So I did that. I did a little bit of coaching with an AAU team, which was super fun, but I just knew I wasn't passionate about it, but it was super exciting and fun. If you're a point guard, you probably know basketball. So coming up with plays and stuff is pretty simple. I just used everything, Messina, Ivkovic, Autumn Rain. So like that was fun, but I knew I wasn't passionate about it. The agent's license was something I was a little bit excited about because I felt like everything you hear about agents, I could be total opposite. You know what I mean? Like, I was a former player. I understand international culture. I understand the league. So if I can get players that want to be in Europe, I can probably help them navigate their European experience a lot better. So I thought about that, but then it was like, man, I'm not only investing money in that, then you have to actually travel to all these colleges, wine and dine these parents, maybe give them, I'm just like, woof, I don't know if I'm built for that, but it's like, I got to, you know, kiss the parents' ring and kiss their friends' ring. And now everybody's social media ring. I'm like, ooh, I don't know if I'm built for that. So then it was the agency thing. But I would say the number one thing that fell through that I really wanted, that I probably was the best that didn't happen, was I was thinking of buying that team in Belgium, Ghent. They had failed a second division and they were in first division when I was there. And a former teammate of mine, Wim van der Keer, was actually now the vice president of the league. So he was helping me with the paperwork and things. That was the one thing I thought I was excited about, because I've always wanted to be a part of building a team, right? Like, that's probably why we're in what we're in now. Part of like, hey, finding this coach and getting this player and mixing it and making it. So that was the one thing I think I was super excited about that I dabbled into. But for the most part, it was just trial and error, man. And my community and my tribe was super important. To your point, you have to find a good foundation. Like, I do have a foundation of faith because I'm a believer in God. So I also had that to lean on. But I had a girlfriend, like I said, who's now my wife. She was like super strong during that time. And like, she knew sometimes she'd be like, oh, just get away. Like, you need to leave. Like, this is not, you know, I know you're frustrated. You're trying to figure this out. You know, my mom and dad, even though, you know, they've been divorced for 40 years since I was probably 5 or 6 years old. Like, I had my mom who was always there telling me like, hey, whatever you want to do, like, I don't care if you fail, like, just try it. And then my dad was more like, you better be saving your money. Don't be spending all your money on these dreams. So I had a good balance, and I had a good community and family oriented that none of them were really money hungry. Like, my mom isn't calling me every day for money. My wife isn't shopping every day. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like I had good people around me that they wanted me to remain successful, but they also was pushing me to find something that, you know, could fulfill that inner drive when you're done playing, because it doesn't leave you. Even right now, when you coach the national team, you do your job with your NBA team. When you go back to the national team, it's like you don't have that job in the NBA. You're really literally sitting there like, this means everything to me. And I think when you have that inner drive, if that's taken away, what is it? Right?
Exactly. Like,
if you didn't have the NBA and you didn't have the net, like, what drives Bennis to be Bennis, and what's going to drive him to that fulfillment of life? If everything else was taken and stripped from you, what are you going to wake up? I'm talking about if family was gone, wife was gone, all those things for me, if they were taken away, what would make me wake up and say, I have to do this because this is what fulfills me? And I think that's what people really struggle with, because things are taken away from you at any time and you have to find something that drives you. And that's why I left you alone after that national team, because I know you, Bennis. Like, I know how much you put into it. But I think that's what also makes you special and really, really great at what you do, is no matter if it was like I said, I remember you when it was just video. Like, I'm like, man, you really up at 4 a.m. cutting the videos? Is that serious? You're like, I'm going to be the best. I don't know what the best is, because I remember us talking about it. You was like, I don't know what the best is, but I'm going to be that. And in my mind, I'm like, I love this dude. Like, this dude is like, I'm like, who's the best video coordinator in the world? You didn't know, but you was like, I'm going to be that. I'm like, that's great. That was amazing to me. And I think that's, you know, that's just a testament, I think, of people that are driven to be successful.
I appreciate that. Yeah, it is tough. It is tough. But things got taken away when I was playing, you know, like, so that, like, my career, and I keep saying that, you know, I'm not like looking for a pity party or anything, but it is like you said, it can be gone any moment, you know, and if you don't really embrace it and try to be the best at that moment, try to make the most out of it, then you're just wasting your time. Basically, move on to something that's better, and that's something that's going to give you like the drive and the adrenaline that you really need. Because I think life, just living life on just a flat line, is too boring. You have to apply yourself to something that's bigger than you, and put yourself out there, put yourself in there, risk being hurt. And then, like, if you're being hurt, if you get hurt, you get hurt, but you, at least, you know, you apply yourself fully. That's in a relationship, that's in life, that's in your profession. I think that's the only way to live. That's the other way around it to me. And I think that most athletes are that way.
I agree. And to your point, trial and error is important. Like, I would never say go spend all your money on one investment, and if it loses, you lose everything. I wouldn't say that. But to your point, like, if you believe in something, you got to give it your all. And your all, sometimes people don't understand, is not financial. Like, giving your all means that, like you said, you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, you're like, yo, I want to watch this video. Not you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, you're like, look, I'm gonna go downstairs and get me a drink. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, to me, that is, I always tell people, like, what would you do if money didn't matter? To me, that's what you should be pursuing. Like, if you really think, like, if you paid me $2 or you paid me $2 million, I want to do this. That's what's going to wake you up in the middle of the night to be creative. That's what's going to wake you up to say, I'm going to do and be the best at this. So I always, you know, that's a big thing for me, to your point of, like, when you find that thing that you would do for nothing that you're getting paid to do and you give it your all, you know, you probably found the right thing. And that's why I said, like, I knew you when it was just video coordinator. Like, you're not who, like, that business is not the same business today, but it's like that business is driven today to do something more. And that's why I think when I get to live through you with your national team, and it's, you know, because I'm still connected to you, you don't understand that. So when you lose, it's like a part of me loses because I know how you driven you are, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I'm cheering for the U.S. because Kevin, you know, like, Kevin Durant is on the team, right? Like, I want him to win, right? Like, yeah. I want him to win. I want the U.S. to win, of course, but, like, I want him to win. But when you have someone that you know that you're kind of invested in, yeah, when they lose, you hurt. So it's like, I personally know you. So I want Lithuania to win because I know how much you put into it. I don't know all the other coaches. I don't know the players, but I know you. And I think that's what's, you know, that's a difficult thing when someone you know puts everything into it and loses. And that's why I understand some of these Olympic athletes that, you know, go into drinking and drugs. Like, when you put your life into something and you come up short, it's really difficult. And I think people don't realize that it's not like going to work every day. Like, the Olympics is every 4 years. After, yep. Like, if your 4 years is up, that's it, Venice. Like, that's it. That you may never go to another Olympics. And I think sometimes that's what I loved about the way you coach, is you don't coach this as saying, like, oh, well, in 4 more years, I'll be back. Oh, well, 2 more years, I'll be in the European Championships. Oh, and next year, you coach as if this is the last time I'm going to coach. And that's why it hurts you so much. And I think that's really, really important for people to understand that if it doesn't hurt, it's probably not what you're most passionate about.
Absolutely. That's why it hurt, because after Rio, like, you, like, we were in Rio, but it was a bad experience. Like, the experience was not fulfilling enough. Then you kind of, like, you want to, like, you know, like, for the competitive, that you want to come back and prove that you really belong, and then come make it, you know, to the top, obviously. And then you fail, and it's just like, not again. Like, that would get away to, like, to see whether or not, like, you know, the coaching staffs change. So it's not a given that I'll be there. It's not a given that anybody will be. It's going to be always, it's a natural dynamic of coaching. So you just don't know if you're going to be in Paris, if you're going to be in LA or in Brisbane. You know, like, the Olympics is just like you said, like, it's the Olympics, and they're like, you feel like your world collapsed in that moment, obviously. But like you said, that we change over the course of years, like 10 years, we both changed as like, we grew as people. We didn't change personality wise, but we grew as people. We have a bit bigger, wider understanding of the world and more dynamics. But the inner drive, the dog in you didn't change, you know, exactly. Like, you still, you have that no matter what. And that's the thing. That's what makes it difficult after retirement, I think, because that dog is still in there and he looks to be fed somehow. And that's that, you know, that feeding process is missing because the excitement is not there. The fans are not there. You're not able to express yourself on the court, on the competitive level. So you feel like, how do I feed this dog? Like, you know, and I think that's the biggest loss after retirement, I think, for many players.
Totally agree. I think you never get that feeling of playing in championships or getting in locker rooms, losing games. Like, I always tell people, I remember the losses way more than I remember the wins. And that community and that team and that tribe, as you said earlier, like, you don't get any closer after a loss, a big loss, than that. Like, it's unreal where you get whether it's Matias Smotis from Slovenia, Theodoros Papaloukas from Greece, Trajan that's, you know, raised in Alaska, Andre Vorontsevich from Russia. Like, when you bring us all together after a loss and you can look at each other and you could tell everybody's so hurt that it meant so much to everybody, like, that sense of family, it's hard to get after basketball because you were all chasing one thing. Like, we were all chasing the same thing. It's different, like, if I'm chasing being a millionaire and you're chasing being a doctor and you're chasing, like, that's all different things. But when you're all together and it's like, I need you in order to get there, it's no, I can't get there without you. I can't win a championship. It's not 1-on-5, like, it's 5-on-5 in basketball. And when you lose and that community and that tribe comes together and you can look at each other and you hurt more for them than for yourself, it's a special feeling, man. And I think people don't understand. That's hard to get that in anything else in life when it's not a group of you trying to chase something that you all want so bad.
This is the most important point, I think, for today, is that it's not replicable in regular life. You cannot replicate a locker room with that much adrenaline and passion, driven to succeed, and everybody's fighting for the same purpose. You can't find that in a regular job, in a regular life situation. You can find something that you're trying to achieve as a group, as an office, as a, like, you know, the dynamics are a little bit different. But the, you know, what makes it different are the emotions, you know, the passion, and it's not replicable in real life. And I think a lot of ex-players, it's hard to grasp that there's no such thing. But when you walking out in Rio in the Olympics in front of 100,000 people in the stadium, just the opening ceremony, like, the adrenaline rush you get is unreal. It's unreal, and it's not natural, you know. And whenever you miss that adrenaline rush and hormonal effects, let's call it, you feel like that, like, this. Is this right or is that right? Like, what's the real world? Like, is this the real world, or are we is the basketball world the real world where it's supposed to be like that all the time and it's not? So, right. I think that's the most important thing to realize. JR, we capped ourselves at 1 hour, and we could keep going because this is good stuff. Like, I think my audio is not the best at all, anyways, but. Yours is the best. Yours is good. So the points you were making were the most important points today. But before we finish off, I wanted to finish with four quick hitters. So I want you to think and see, remember of what, or remember or look forward to with these four quick hitters that I prepared. You're the first one to tell me about the bucket list. I mean, I knew about the bucket list, but about really pursuing it. So I wanted to know, what's the next thing on your bucket list that you still want to check off?
NBA champion, man. I've always dreamed as a kid that I wanted to play in an NBA championship, but we both know how God works. I got to be in an Olympics. I would never give an NBA championship to not be in that Olympics. So that was never on my bucket list to play in the Olympics. So, you know, to actually experience that, as you said, is incredible. So my next thing on my bucket list, man, would be, as far as me, my personal professional life would be to win an NBA championship. And my personal life is literally, I live by the same as I live by as a player, man. I want to be a better father, husband every day. Like, I try to take steps every day of, like, I wake up in the morning, like, can I be a little bit better today to my kids, a little bit better today to my wife? And that's a bucket list in itself, because, you know, we have our good days and our bad, but that's a real thing for me. Like, hey, man, I want to be a better man today, because I feel like the more we live, the more we know death is inevitable, and you don't know when it's when it's your time. And I want to be remembered by my family more, you know, more sacredly than anybody else in the world.
Biggest regret of your career?
Biggest regret. That's hard, B, because I don't really have a lot of regrets with basketball. Man, this is tough. Biggest regret. I will say this. I don't think I've ever said this before. I don't want to use quit because I've never quit in a basketball game. But my biggest regret is mentally checking out of that Final Four in Greece. At halftime, I thought I had played a pretty solid first half. And Messina came in and I was pretty excited. I was like, we about to win this. And to start the second half, he was just like, you, and he skipped over me. And I had, in my whole time at Seska, my whole career in basketball, I had never not started the second half of the game, ever. And I mentally checked out. Like, I mentally said, well, you want to win it without me? Go ahead. And I wasn't a good teammate because I just sat on the bench. I wanted us to win. I never don't want to win, but I wasn't into the game. I would say my biggest regret is mentally checking out of a game that we ended up losing by like 1 point or something, that if I would have stayed in, checked in mentally, I believe we would have won. So I would say that's my biggest regret of my career, that I feel like I let a country, Seska, my teammates down just because I had checked out, and I let somebody, a coach, check me out, not a player, not me playing bad, but to let somebody's words and just him saying, you not starting, check me out. So I would say that's the biggest regret of my professional career. And to this day, I think a lot of reasons I never went back to back into EuroLeague is because I checked out of that game.
Thanks for sharing that. That's a big time lesson for the next generation too. Biggest lesson you learned or habit that you picked up while in Europe?
The best lesson I learned in Europe was to slow down. I think a lot of times, like, you know, when they have breaks in Europe, B, you know, they might have a lunch break from 12 to 3 o'clock. Like, in America, it's like 30 minutes back to work, right? Like, yeah. You can't, like, you eating your lunch real fast. What I learned in Europe is, like, to truly appreciate the time that you actually get to spend with someone. So like my first time in Italy, I felt like they had like 19 meals to eat dinner. I'm like, man, I want to eat and go. But we sat there for 3 hours eating. And I'm like, they appreciate good company. They appreciate actually spending time with someone that they want to spend time with. So I think my biggest lesson in Europe is like, when you get a chance to spend time with good people, cherish that time and don't rush it. No matter what else you have going on in that day, don't miss right now. Like, I'm not taking, like, you have stuff to do today. I have stuff to do today. I'm living in the moment of me and you just talking on this podcast or on this video. Like, it's truly important to me. I want to learn from you as much as you want to learn from me. You have all these thoughts going on my mind about, like, my life and my career and what do I have going forward. I'm living in this. So if you said, hey, we're going to go another 30 minutes, I don't care what else I have going on. This time right here is the most important. You know what I mean? And I think to me, Europe taught me that is like, appreciate the great people you have around you. Never take them for granted. And when you get a chance to spend time with them, like I'm getting a chance to spend time with you right now, enjoy it and embrace it, man. And whenever you say click off, that's when we clicking off.
That's all love, man. I appreciate it. Yeah. No rush. Yeah. Just no rush, and take one step at a time. Enjoy the moments while you're in it. So last one, biggest change of J.R. Holden from player to after player, after during retirement, since retirement, basically, what's the biggest personality change or biggest change that you experienced in your life?
Personality would just be like becoming a full-time dad, man, is probably the biggest change. Being home every day, not every day because, you know, we travel for work, but like, being a family man, like I never really imagined being a family man growing up. Like I didn't grow up with mom and dad in a house. So I never really thought that would be me. And I think I've went through my ups and downs with it. You know, I can speak honestly, like I have a therapist that helps me through navigate the marriage life and being a good father and all that. Like that's something I never knew really about as far as like being here every day and being an emotional sounding board for my wife. Like I didn't know these things and I'm still not great at them. I'm navigating them now. But I do have a therapist to kind of navigate through those. It's not like a mental issue more for me. It's just like, I want to be better as a husband and better as a father. And I knew that I didn't know how to do these things, and I'm having someone help me, you know, be a better person and a better evolve as a husband. So those, I'm definitely doing that. I would say that's a big change for me.
That's one thing I can add to that, because now you said it, his name is Jason Wilson. Have you heard of him?
The name, I feel like I've heard that name before.
I'm just like the recent episode with Joe Rogan came out, and he's talking about how he applies jiu-jitsu principles to young kids, young men, young boys, basically, and teaches them how to be responsible, accountable, and not seek out fights, but handle your emotions the right way. And that episode with Joe Rogan, just the recent one, it's okay. Worth listening to. He's the one that was, remember this kid? He was the coach who was teaching this kid to, I think it was just like hitting breaking a karate board with his hand, and it didn't break. Yeah. And he started crying, and the kid started crying, and that video went viral. He was just like teaching, like, it's okay to cry. Like, it's okay. Like, just let it out, regather yourself, and center back, and then he ended up breaking the board, you know. And that's like when you feel like the pressure got to the kid, and he was able to teach him to handle the pressure, because he had broken the board before. It's just that the testing period was on, and he felt the pressure, you know, and the young boy started to cry. So those things I think are very important that you address, you know, like to help having a therapist or seeking out somebody that really can help you navigate through this maze that we're in. We are in a maze that's called life. And we're all trying to figure out as we go. And I think today's episode will be a lesson for a lot of players, current players, ex-players, everybody who's dealing with retirement. And your story, we could dig a lot deeper and a lot more out, but, you know, like, let's keep it for another time. I think that it was really good, and I really appreciate it. And everybody, are you easy to find or not? Like, I don't know how you do.
I'm easy to find, Bennis. And if they can't find me, you can find me. So they go through you, they can get to me anytime.
All right.
Easy to find. And I'm Bennis. I want to say thank you, man. Like, seriously, I know this is something that's, you know, you're passionate about, and you really have dug into something that I would have never guessed. Like I said, I just seen you, I think 2 or 3 years ago, we were at a tournament, and I didn't even know, like, you had all these things in your mind that you have going. So, man, I just want to say thank you for inviting me, brother. You know, I can't wait to get together with you and hang out and have our long 3-hour talks. And
we'll break bread again soon.
For sure. So I just want to say thanks, man. Truly, I'm honored to be a part of this.
Thanks. Thanks a lot again. And everybody, go through me to JR. I'll be the filter. Thanks for being on, everybody, and talk to you soon. I hope you enjoyed it.
All righty.